This is the State of Things from the American Tobacco Historic District. I'm Frank Stachow. Journalist Mark Pinsky started out covering crime for newspapers all over the Southeast. After years of writing about law enforcement, attorneys, autopsies, and trials, Mark decided he had had enough of the underside of human nature. He made the transition to religion reporting and became a well-respected columnist and author. But there was one cold case Mark just couldn't shake from his mind, one that he hadn't even been assigned to cover. In the summer of 1970, a young woman named Nancy Morgan was brutally attacked and murdered in Madison County, North Carolina. Nancy was 23 years old, a community organizer who was scheduled to attend nursing school that fall. Mark first read about the crime while he was a student at Duke University, spent more than 40 years poring over the details of Nancy Morgan's life and tragic death, hoping to find some answers and satisfy his own strange obsession with a woman he never knew. Mark is working on a forthcoming book about Nancy Morgan, and he's my guest on the program today to share what he's learned. Mark Pinsky, welcome back to The State of Things.
Frank, it's great to be back.
Tell us about when you first learned about the death of Nancy Morgan.
It was 6 weeks after Kent State, the killings at Kent State, and classes had been canceled at Duke University, and I was on the third floor of Flowers Building on the campus, overlooking the statue of Buck Duke. And I was going through the paper, and I opened the paper in the Chronicle office, and I saw an article in the Durham Sun which talked about this young woman. There was a photo of her, how her body had been found. She was a Vista worker, an anti-poverty worker, kidnapped, raped, and murdered. And it just struck me in my heart. Much of it was political, kind of generational solidarity, even though I didn't know her. In the 30s, they used to say an injury to one is an injury to all, and I felt that. And I took a metal pica ruler and cut out the clip and got a manila folder and started a file. And I somehow knew I would not let it go.
And you were a reporter for the Chronicle at the time, right?
I was the former editor, one of the editors of the Chronicle, and just about to go out into the world and begin. Actually, from the Chronicle, I went to the local underground press, the Protean Radish and the North Carolina Plain Dealer. And then I went to work for AP, and then I sort of went straight more or less for a while.
And you had and what did you have? The Readable Radical was your column.
My column at the Chronicle was the Readable Radical. Right?
So you were planning on a career in journalism, which it turns out happened. But you clipped this one article, and as you said, I guess a certain sense of solidarity. Here's a worker, the what we call the Domestic Peace Corps, Vista, right? She's up in the mountains, and she gets killed. What did you think? Was there a picture in the paper?
There was.
So
she looked like a lot of my friends, and she was an Air Force brat, and my girlfriend at the time was a military kid, and so I kind of felt that additional affinity.
And how did she die?
She was found hogtied in a government car, her hands and legs behind her back, and plastic twine around her neck, and she basically struggled, and she strangled, and she died.
You said you mentioned the Kent State killings, which happened just weeks earlier, and I think you'd written that there a line from Crosby, Stills, Nash & Young's song flashed through your mind as you read this piece.
Well, later when the song Ohio came out, and there was one line saying, "What would you knew her? What if you knew her and found her dead on the ground?" And I didn't know Nancy Morgan. I didn't find her dead on the ground, but I felt the same sort of pull that this was something that needed to be attended to. No one likes to leave their compatriots on the field behind them.
By the time that song came out, how far along were you in the investigation, or should I say, when did you decide to take this on as I guess, a crusade is what it became?
Well, there's another triangle connection, because in the early 70s, several years later, I took a job as a researcher for Jacqueline Dowd Hall at the Southern Oral History Project. And my job was to go through the North Carolina collection and do prep notes for interviews with major North Carolina figures. And just by chance, or providence, I don't know really, I opened a file that said Zeno Ponder. And I read all these clips about this person who had been the longtime political boss up in Madison County where the murder took place. He'd been the chairman of the Democratic Party for decades. His brother was E.Y. Ponder, who had been the sheriff for decades. And the clip said that Madison County at that time had only 17,000 people, and that these two brothers knew everything that went on in that county. And, you know, the conspiratorial mind, the Southern Gothic mind, I thought, small county, political corruption perhaps, political control for sure. Maybe these men knew who killed Nancy Morgan, or even worse, maybe they might have had something to do with it. So I photocopied all the articles about Zeno Ponder and added that to my original file and determined that I would then write about it for sure. A few years later, I made my first visit to Madison County in 1978. Another triangle connection, I stayed with a man many of your listeners may know named Elmer Hall, who had been assistant Methodist chaplain and a real political guiding light in the 60s at Duke, then went on to be co-founder of Sometime Restaurant in Durham, and then went up to Madison County to Hot Springs, where he ultimately took over an inn called Sunnybank Inn and Retreat Center, which is still in existence now. And he had just moved up there in 78 when my wife, or future wife, and I went up there to talk to him. And I told him that I wanted to write a book about Nancy Morgan. And I asked him if he would keep his ears open for me and listen. Now, Elmer was a strong-willed kind of person. He wanted me to write a book about the Ponders. And I said, well, we'll see. We'll see, Elmer.
Might be the same book, but it turns out perhaps not. So now this is 8 years after the crime. Where was the investigation by then?
By that time, the investigation had been closed. There was a question of jurisdiction because she was a federal government employee. She was in a government car. She was found on National Forest. Her body was found on National Forest territory, but it just was formerly in the state. So in the initial weeks, there was confusion as to who had jurisdiction, the sheriff, the SBI, or the FBI. And they were sort of bumping into each other for a couple weeks. And ultimately, the FBI took it over and gave it up after about 8 months, and it just was sort of packed away.
So in less than a year, the crime is unsolved, and it becomes a cold case. You're still on it in 1978. What did you learn? Did you spend much time investigating or just—
Not in the early years, yeah. Not early. I just sort of touched base with Elmer every so often, and he would hear rumors. He would hear suggestions about who people thought it was. And there was a real cultural divide in Madison County in those years because in the early to mid-70s, the back-to-the-land hippies or lefties moved into Madison County, and the specter of Nancy Morgan's murder hung heavy on Madison County. And the people in Madison County thought only an outsider could have done such a horrible thing. And all the outsiders thought, oh, no, only these local people could do such a horrible thing. And it was, really became a cultural divide in the county.
And just take us back a little bit because, coincidentally, the history of Madison County is interesting and bloody as well, right?
Yes, it was the same community that Nancy Morgan lived in, Shelton Laurel, sometimes known as the Sodom community, was the site of the Shelton Laurel massacre during the Civil War, where a number of Union sympathizers, were, including a 13-year-old boy, were taken out and shot, 13 of them. And it gave Madison County the sad nickname of Bloody Madison for many years. And so when Nancy's murder took place, there were people who felt, oh, no,
yeah,
here we go again.
Not this again. So you go back, you talk with a friend about keeping his eyes and ears open. How active were you? Because by now you've got a career as a journalist going. You're actually active in the field.
Right. By that time, I had gone to work for the Los Angeles Times out in Southern California, way distant from here. And I would say my efforts were dormant until about 1994, when I felt it was time to move on from the LA Times. And I wanted to come back in the Southeast because I wanted, this was unfinished business with me. So I began doing early internet searches, forensic searches, getting autopsy reports, police reports, doing a paperwork while I was still in California. And as I began my job search in several jobs here in the Triangle, which didn't pan out, and then ultimately in Orlando, where I ended up, I would use my prospective employer's money to route my way through Madison County. And so in 1994, I began my regular trips to Madison County, usually a week in the spring and a week in the autumn.
Were you a crime reporter by then? What were you doing at the LA Times?
Yes and no. I spent the 70s before I went to LA covering capital murder, racial justice cases. I was an early writer about the Wilmington 10, the Charlotte 3. The first murder case I covered was the Joanne Little rape murder case. And I did a lot of the Dawson 5, a lot of capital cases involving indigent. I started out writing about defendants who were poor, black, and innocent, and I got so good at it, I ended up writing about defendants who were wealthy, white, and guilty. And so by the end of the 70s, I was covering Ted Bundy and Jeffrey McDonald murder cases.
So, but you're also getting good at understanding what forensic evidence is. You know about the autopsy. You understand how a police investigation works.
Right. I spent a lot of time in courtrooms covering capital cases from beginning to end, from early jury selection procedures. I even took a death scene analysis course up in Corning, New York, by the person who developed the blood spatter analysis with all these homicide detectives and coroner's investigators. So I got pretty good at it. But then it got to be too much. The capstone was November of 1979, the Klan Nazi shootings in Greensboro, and some of my friends were killed and wounded, and I had to cover that, and I felt a real sort of pull. You know, what side am I on exactly? Am I a journalist? Am I an activist? I got into journalism because of politics.
Well, I want to talk more about that, about an activist, about how you take on the mind of an investigator and a prosecutor and remain a journalist. As our conversation continues today with Mark Pinsky, forthcoming book that he has written examines the murder of a young woman named Nancy Morgan, who was killed in Madison County, North Carolina in 1970. You're listening to The State of Things from North Carolina Public Radio, a broadcast service of the University of North Carolina, Chapel Hill. Please stay with us. This is The State of Things from the American Tobacco Historic District. I'm Frank Stacio. Today I'm talking with author Mark Pinsky, former staff writer for the L.A. Times and the Orlando Sentinel. He's written a number of books, including The Gospel According to the Simpsons. His latest is Amazing Gifts. His next project is a book about the life and death of a young woman named Nancy Morgan, killed in North Carolina more than 40 years ago. Mark believes he knows who the murderer is. So where are we now? We're in the mid-90s. You've taken up the case again. How active did you get, and were you learning anything new?
Well, I began learning things new. What I decided, because so many years had gone by, I made a list of about 50 people I wanted to talk to, and I started with the oldest first, because I wanted to catch them, A, before they died, or B, before their memories fogged over, if they would speak to me. So each time I would go up to stay at Elmer's place, I would come up on a Sunday and begin making phone calls. Without being melodramatic, I mean, I am trying to solve an unsolved murder at this point, so I didn't let anyone know when I was coming until I was there. I made the phone calls, arranged the interviews for the week, did the interviews, and then was gone. And always rented a car with North Carolina plates on it and told Elmer, if I'm late, go find me.
Still, a place like that where only two brothers know what's going on everywhere, that outsiders raise suspicions when they start asking questions about cold cases.
Right. So it was important. I only did my interviews during the day. Stayed off the road at night. And people were amazingly hospitable to me, amazingly open to me. Of course, the closer the familial relationships to people who might have been involved were, the more circumspect or resistant people were.
Did you talk to Nancy's family about this?
I did.
How did they feel about you doing this?
One of her brothers was very supportive. The other brother was reluctant. Her father had died at this point, and I made a decision not to talk to her mother. I just did not want to hurt her by ripping that scab off. My promise to them was that I would leave them alone until I knew something that I could bring to them. And as it happened, her mother died about a year ago, so her mother never knew about the book project, but her brother was extremely helpful to me. But mostly the local people, because I was staying with Elmer, a lot of people would speak to me who probably would not have spoken to me without. He's a wonderful person. He has great gravitas.
Did you talk to the police?
I did. I probably talked to four different sheriffs, and I talked to E.Y. Ponder. E.Y. Ponder was very gracious to me. He's passed now, but he gave me a lot of time, and subsequent sheriffs gave me a lot of time. Now, whether they were entirely candid, whether they were telling me the truth, that's a judgment that I had to make ultimately.
What were their suspicions? What do they think happened?
Well, E.Y. Ponder was convinced that the person he arrested and tried in 1984 was the guilty party, even though a local jury, even though he was a long-haired guy from Florida who was a fellow Vista, a local jury acquitted him in an hour. And as a result, E.Y. lost the next election, I think, because of that prosecution. But E.Y. stuck to the idea that it was this person who I call Ed Walker in my book. And
Yeah, and that, he was the outsider, so that he made a nice, a good choice in that case.
Politically,
that made a good choice. How about you? You talk about your relationship with Nancy Morgan, the fact that in a sense it becomes an infatuation, maybe even a kind of a sense of love that you felt for her.
Right. It's biographers are warned not to fall in love with their subjects, and I wouldn't say I fell in love with her at all, but I did. I had to reconstruct her life. To find out what brought her to Madison County and to put her in this sort of situation. And it was, you know, I found letters. Her friends gave me letters. I had documents. I had all these other kinds of things, reminiscences from other friends, school records. And she was a person who in many ways was like many of us, a middle-class, white middle-class person, her military family, not political at all at the beginning of the 60s. I read her early letters, and I was almost turned off by her because she seemed so superficial, always talking about boys and sewing and cooking. But then you can track her life. Then 64, 65, she begins to get interested in civil rights and concerned about civil rights. She's living in Northern Virginia by this time. Her dad is at the Pentagon. Then the war comes on, and you can see in her letters she's becoming more socially concerned about the war and about poverty. She goes to college. She has an affair with an older college professor. She becomes pregnant. The college professor wants to marry her. She doesn't want to marry. She has an abortion. It's traumatic for her family. So it's almost, she is almost Zelig-like in her tracing of the 60s generation. So she was like so many of us. We weren't so political as the 60s generation because we were so smart or so caring. The world just took us by the lapels and shook us. And she was changed like I was changed. And the more the decade of my reconstruction passed, the closer I felt to her.
It's interesting because you have that one moment as you're reading the early entries in her diary that you they feel a little distance, and then you end up being even closer to her because her trajectory felt more like yours.
She was one of us.
Yeah. So, and what kind of work was she doing in Madison County?
She was doing the normal kinds of things. She was doing clothes co-ops, food co-ops, malnutrition, youth recreation stuff. But I think she understood the limitations of what she was doing, giving her credentials, which is why she planned to go to nursing school. She wanted to become a public health nurse and return to Madison County, where she felt she could do some really, really important, lasting work.
You pick this up, as you say, in the mid-90s. You start doing interviews. You go back to Elmer Hall's place, and you're visiting more often. How much a part of your life and your career did this begin to intrude on your career at all?
It's very odd. In the book, I say that I live in a Orlando suburb, two children, Volvo, Birkenstocks, the rest of it, regular job. I said 50 weeks a year, I was Ward Cleaver. And then 2 weeks a year, I was either Raymond Chandler or Walter Mitty, depending on how you did it. It was a real culture contact because I would leave my suburban life and then go up to the Hollers and do stuff that, I mean, journalists solve murders all the time in mysteries, movies, and on TV. I'm an old cop reporter. In real life, it rarely, rarely happens. So I had to get my head out of the suburbs and into the Hollers. And then when I came back, there was a sort of weeks period where I had to get the Hollers out of my life and return to PTA and rec basketball and all the rest of it.
And could you do that? Could you shake it back at the PTA meeting?
I could. Yeah. My wife still says that I never seemed more invigorated than when I came back from Madison County.
Talk to about, you say that in the movies it happens that the reporters solve the crime. It rarely happens in real life. But the mentality of the crime reporter, you really get yourself into the mindset of the investigator. You're working along with him, aren't you? Does that happen to you? You're trying to solve the crime?
Most in true crime books, and I don't want to say this is a true crime because there's a larger political, sociological context. The hero is usually some dogged detective who can't give the case up, or a new detective who finds a cold case file and goes back to it. I didn't have that. I sort of had to carry that. At periods of time, there were sheriffs who wanted to sort of get into it, and they would look into it, and it, with no easy, quick solution, they sort of lost interest in it. So it was kind of up to me. But I've been around the track enough times to know how you do something like this. It doesn't always work out. And in my case, there's still some ambiguity. I believe I found out who did it, and I got a confession. The SBI and the local law enforcement authorities don't agree. They, and we don't have definitive DNA. We don't have definitive polygraph. But I'm convinced that I know who did it.
How much evidence did you have access to? Could you open up the file and take a look?
I was lucky. I had the autopsy report. I had the police report. And then because there was a confusion of jurisdiction the first year, there was a 200-page FBI report. It was redacted. It took me 2 years to get it under Freedom of Information Act. But that was extremely helpful, very detailed. Again, redacted, blacked out stuff. But it has margin notes from J. Edgar Hoover. This case was so important at the time that they're valuable margin notes. And it's a comment, and it will say J.E.H., J. Edgar Hoover.
No. Any notes like get dressed back from cleaners?
No.
I'm just wondering.
Get Clyde to make dinner.
What were your theories along the way? Did they change much? What did you think initially? You must have had some opinions, and what were they? Have they changed?
One of the things that I learned as a police reporter early on is I always begin with I accept the prosecution's view. I go in believing that whoever was arrested was guilty, and I need to convince myself that they're not guilty. I don't go in saying I'm going to save an innocent person, because that works on your biases. It works on how you evaluate the evidence. So I had to prove to myself that the person who they said did it didn't do it to my satisfaction. And in this case, that was true. I found the person who had been tried, whose life had essentially been ruined, even though he was acquitted. And we spent hours and hours talking about it. And ultimately, he came back with me to Madison County to confront the person who I believe was responsible for it. A very dramatic scene in the book. I have to convince myself. I don't want to go in with this brief. I'm going to save this person. Because that then you begin to filter all the forensic material that you have. Mm-hmm. And then there was a story where I got the state to dig up preserved DNA evidence, which was locked in a warehouse in Chapel Hill. And finally, through my pressure, essentially, got the SBI to evaluate it. But as we know, that may not be as reliable as one.
Well, and it's not definitive. They have run the test, right?
In my case, it was not definitive.
Because there was nothing to match. So there's only been one arrest and trial in all of this.
Correct.
That ended in acquittal. You went back with the defendant in that case. Did he have any ideas about who might have done it?
He had a general sense of who it was. And as I dug up more and more specific evidence, that began to resonate with him. But even he was reluctant to accept my scenario. He was careful too, because he felt he had been unjustly accused. Mm. And so he was careful about blaming anyone else. Ultimately, he came to accept my scenario.
And that is what?
That it was a crime of opportunity, no conspiracy. Five young men sitting by a bridge, drinking beer all day, watching Nancy drive to visit someone else, and knowing roughly who she was, knowing she had to come back a certain way. And later that night, when she came back a certain way, they jumped in two cars, boxed her in, made her pull over, and took her away. And then held her for several days where there were multiple sexual assaults. And then I believe they tied her up, they hogtied her, not with the intention of killing her, just to sort of until they would use her again or decide whether to drop her off or not. And she struggled, I think, and she died. I don't think it was premeditated murder by any stretch.
When did you come to that? When did you have that theory, and how did you develop it?
A part of it was based on some sketchy information that Elmer had come across. And then I began doing, based on that, I did some more, some names began to pop up. And several of the five men were dead at that point. Several were in the wind. And I found one who was incarcerated nearby Madison County. And I called up the prison. I said, I want to talk to this person. I didn't say why. I went to talk to him. And he confessed when I talked to him. Now, there's always the possibility that he's making things up. He was already in prison for murdering his daughter, poisoning his daughter, and he was a lifelong ne'er-do-well. He was like a character out of the early Cormac McCarthy, or Wile E. Cash book, or Charles Frazier book, a real character, or Faulkner, for that matter.
So what happened when you took that confession, a verbal confession? Obviously, you don't have anything on paper, right? And you went to the authorities. Who'd you tell?
I waited. First of all, they wouldn't let me record the confession. So all I had was, he said, he told me. So I contacted the person who had been convicted, and I said, he told me this story. This is the story. And he said he'd be willing to apologize to you for what it did to your life. And to my surprise, the person who had been arrested agreed to come up from where he was living. And we both went back for a second visit to this person and the prison chaplain with us. So he repeated in detail this confession in front of these three people, still no recording, But at that point, I felt more confident in going to the, there was a new sheriff. And he said, it's interesting. He would pursue it, et cetera. And ultimately, I went back to Central Prison where this person was then transferred, and I did get a recorded confession. But the SBI reopened the investigation, did some polygraphs, said they were indeterminate, and in the end felt that they still thought the person who had originally been arrested was responsible. They wanted him to take a DNA test. And he, having been the victim of the SBI, said, I'll take a DNA test, but not from them. I'll take an independent DNA test. And the SBI said, no, we don't deal with independent DNA tests. So it left was left there.
But then the DNA, there was no match with the man who
there
gave
was no
the
match with this one person.
Yeah.
But since there were four people involved, we don't know.
And in the confession, did he lay out the details? Did he tell you what
Absolutely.
Happened according to him?
Absolutely. And then I did go to the other person who was still alive and in the area, who he said he was with. It's an odd experience to sit on a couch with someone and say, did you kill Nancy Morgan? That's a conversation stopper, to be sure. But he said, no, he said he was with this person that day. He was at the bridge. They were drinking together, but he didn't do all these other things. And he pointed to a dent in his forehead where he had been shot. He said, well, you know, I've been shot once and I've had a couple strokes, so my memory's not as good as it could be.
Well, so, and as you said, the man you suspected the crime, we're not going to use his name on this program because there's just, we can't do that. And it wouldn't be right at all. But the person you suspect of doing it is in prison now for the rest of his life for this other crime. Is there any interest on the part of the authorities to reopen this case and do a more thorough examination?
There's been sporadic interest, but oftentimes if you don't get a path to solution in a relatively quick period of time with this, they have to move on to other cases. And so we just, they and I have had just to agree to disagree.
And his confession wouldn't be enough in this case?
Well, given his record as a kind of career small-time criminal and pathological liar, probably not.
Yeah, and the fact that there's obviously some pretty serious problems with this emotionally. If he poisoned his daughter, I'm guessing you could make the case.
Correct.
That not all is right with him. What happened? I'm curious to know how the original suspect who was acquitted in this case, what that meeting was like, particularly when the person who claims to have done it apologized. What happened at that meeting?
Well, we recount that in the book. And at first, he told me later, he thought the guy was lying. He didn't want to let himself finally accept that here is what really happened. Here is the event that caused him so much problem. I mean, when he was acquitted, but he had a 13-year-old daughter who tried to kill herself around this time. His wife divorced him ultimately. His career was derailed. Psychologically, he says he wakes up oftentimes mornings thinking he's just been arrested. He didn't want to let himself accept it, but I debriefed him after we left, immediately after we left on tape, and he said it all fit to him finally. It fit. It was plausible to him. He was as skeptical as I was. You would think he would leap at the opportunity for exoneration, you know. He said, I was skeptical, but the more he talked, the more it fit into place.
Well, but it didn't give him any sense of relief ultimately, or
no,
did it?
Huh? It didn't.
Well, what about you? The book is Unfinished Business. Is it over? Is it finished now?
I hope. I hope it's pretty much finished. Now the manuscript is with several publishers, some within the sound of my voice. And I'm hoping that a decision will be reached one way or the other by early October. I have some updates based on the scandal involving the SBI and the laboratory there, but it's basically finished, I think. And I'm hoping that it'll be published before too long. 40 years is a long time.
It is, but how about for you emotionally and your relationship with Nancy Morgan?
I feel good. I mean, I look at the arc of my adult life from when I started becoming politically conscious in the 60s, I came to journalism as a means of doing politics and doing good. And I feel like this is returning me to that part of my life. It's almost a conclusion of something that I kind of got away from more explicit political writing and activity in the middle of my life, my adult life. And now I feel like I've come back to it. I've been marching in the Occupy Orlando movement, and I've been marching for Trayvon Martin, which is Sanford, which is right up the road from my home. I feel like I'm getting back to where I started.
If you look back at this whole project, which could in some ways be characterized as an outlier, something outside of your career path, does it feel to you now more integrated, more like it was really a part of what you were doing all along, or is it still an outside project?
No, I think it's kind of a professional conclusion, a political conclusion, because I used the tools I learned as I got away from politics about covering murder and covering courtrooms, and I've used those tools to bring me back to the kind of cases and causes that drew me to journalism as a young man.
Mark, always a pleasure to talk with you.
Frank, it's great to be back.
Mark Pinsky, former staff writer for the LA Times and Orlando Sentinel, author of a number of books, his most recent, Amazing Gifts. He has completed a forthcoming book, which we hope to see in print soon, about the death of Nancy Morgan, murdered in Madison County, North Carolina in 1970, the working title Unfinished Business, the true story of an Appalachian cold case murder. Just ahead, we'll talk about the life and legacy of jazz luminary John Coltrane. Stay tuned to The State of Things.